Okay, hello everyone and welcome to HQ Overtime, the official post-game show for Raptors HQ, SB Nation's Raptors team site. My name is John Godis, and Fear the Sword and Hoops Habit writer Justin Rowan will be joining me momentarily to discuss Game 4 of the first round series between the Pacers and Raptors. Obviously, a loss to the hands of the Pacers, 100-83 was your final score there. Housekeeping, you can submit your questions for us either in the comments of our post-game show article at RaptorsHQ.com or by tweeting at RaptorsHQ and myself at John Godis. That's J-O-H-N-G-A-U-D-E-S. We will definitely try to get to everyone if you reach out. We know we've got a few of you hanging on here for getting your question answered. It's been a busy afternoon for hearing from people about this one. You can also get this show on the go by downloading the Mixlr app for iOS or Android and following RaptorsHQ. So, Justin, I know you watched the game. We're outsourcing for the first time here for somebody outside the site, but I know you've kind of got the Raptors on your radar all season, and this one was obviously disappointing on a whole bunch of levels. What was your overall impression of it?
Sadness. I mean, what else can you say? Game three, you really hope that they were overcame that mental barrier. They had gotten over the hump. They evened up the series, and then they came out with a dominant performance. Now, I expected Indy's best punch. It was just bound to happen. Toronto won game three despite not shooting fantastic from the floor. They played good defense. I figured Indy would come out with a strong effort. But again, it just seems like Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan, they didn't set the tempo. They didn't set the pace. It was herky-jerky. They didn't go to Jonas enough. And unlike in the regular season, it wasn't Jonas being passive and not establishing position. He was establishing position. He just wasn't being rewarded with the ball.
Yeah, and that's been happening a lot. So Valanciunas, I mean, 6-for-7. That's almost typical of what we've seen from him in this series. I mean, he didn't have a good shooting game, I think, in the first game, but he was still pretty dominant. But I think what people want to talk about here is going to be DeMar DeRozan. So he was 4-for-15 in this game. He didn't go to the line at all. He shot 2 threes, missed them both, turned it over 6 times, just 8 points for DeRozan. He's had a horrific series, but this was probably the most horrific of the bunch.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And again, it comes down to decision making, because DeRozan is an improved player. There's no denying that. His handle is so much better. He is able to get to the rack whenever he wants to, but he's not making the typical decisions. And Leo Rowden's even pointed out in the broadcast where DeRozan had an open shot, but he decided not to take it, ended up putting it on the floor, turned it over. And that indecision is what's throwing him off. You're not going to get the same calls in the playoffs. It's frustrating. It is what it is. But if he's not getting to the free throw line, he's going to need to be efficient in those other areas. And because he's hesitating and because he doesn't recognize what the right play is, he's just forcing the issue. And at this point, it's just snowballing where these performances are getting worse and worse for him.
Yeah, I mean, in game three, he saw a little bit of time with Monte Ellis guarding him, and he took advantage of that in the beginning of the game. And I thought that was good for him to maybe get a rhythm going, but it seemed like from this one they decided to go against that, to have Paul George guard him from the start once again. And just like in games one and two, this seemed to throw him off. How much credit do you give George for him shutting down DeRozan, and how much of this is just DeRozan's bad decision-making? I know it's a combination of both, but is there anything to look forward to from DeRozan for the rest of the series?
I don't know what to expect for the rest of the series. I think you do have to credit Paul George. One thing that I was a little, or what I anticipated coming into the series, was that if George was going to give the focus and the intensity to shut down DeRozan, it's going to impact his offensive game. And Indy, being not the strongest offensive team, would suffer if that was what happened. So I figured that his defense would kind of suffer for the sake of the offense, but that hasn't been the case. Paul George has been dominant on both ends of the court, and with DeRozan making things easier for him with the decision making, it's making Paul George look like clearly the best player in the series, which he is.
Yeah, and Paul George's line tonight, 19 points, 6-for-16, a little bit better. Not a great shooting percentage, but he was pretty well off in this game. Damari Carroll threw him off his game, but he was part of a machine, I think, in this one. The Pacers offense got contributions from other places for the first time in the series. Jan Mahimi was 9-for-14 with 22, and George Hill was 9-for-11 with 22, and they actually led the team in scoring.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the Pacers. They made a minute adjustment by putting Miles Turner in the starting lineup. That is kind of an extension of what we talked about after game three on this show, where I pointed out that Frank Vogel had taken advantage of Luis Scola being on the floor by playing Turner at the four for a little bit and then playing George at the four for a bit. We didn't see a lot of George at the four. I'm not sure if he played at all at the power forward position, but that Miles Turner move really exposed Luis Scola in this game, and he's been exposed all series, but it seemed to be even worse this time.
Yeah, there really isn't a lot of... There isn't a point of playing Luis Scola, at least in my eyes. In the regular season, Scola at least gives you some offensive punch. But in this series, when Jonas Valanciunas has it going the way he does, you'd almost be better off playing Jason Thompson next to him, because at least then you have a defensive stopper next to him. If I was Dwayne Casey, I'd counter with Patrick Patterson, at least in the starting lineup, and I think you would be able to get away with going small, because as you said, even though Paul George might technically be listed as power forward in certain sets, he doesn't defend the power forward position. They've had CJ Miles do that throughout the season. So in a lot of those lineups, play Damari Carroll at the four, play Norman Powell at the three with Lowry and DeRozan, or if DeRozan keeps going this way, sit him for Corey Joseph. But I think Norman Powell's been so good that you have to find a way to get him on the court. Damari Carroll's looked a lot better, and I think going small is the best way to maximize this roster, at least against Indiana.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. And we saw from Indy the other adjustment was Lavoie Allen falling out of the rotation, getting more minutes for Solomon Hill. He was okay. He was a plus 15, but only 2-for-4 for 7 points. A couple backbreaking shots from Hill, but again, it just goes back to the fact that Indy is not that deep of a team. Even when they make adjustments, that back end of their rotation, it's not very good. Mm-hmm. So we kind of shift here. We've got a 2 out of 3 situation for the Raptors. They've got to win their home games, you would expect, but what do you expect to see in game five? Are we going to see the team that came out and dominated game three, or is it going to be another lackluster effort like game four?
Well, I mean, I'm a stubborn person, so I'm going to stick with my prediction. When I did the series preview for Hoops Habit, I said that the Raptors were going to win the series in 6 games, that one game they were going to choke it, another one Indy was just going to outplay them, and then outside of that, the Raptors are going to win their four. So game one, I'm going to call that the choke job. They were in it. They just shot themselves in the foot. This last game, I think Indy just outplayed them. Toronto, yes, they did play bad, but Indy really came out. They knew they couldn't fall behind 3-1 in the series. Otherwise, they're hooped. They're not going to win those two in Toronto, at least not with that pressure. My gut tells me Toronto wins game five. What happens for game six, it's up in the air, but I'm going to stick with my prediction of Raptors in six, although that feels optimistic, and there's no way that I could possibly feel good about that right now.
Yeah, I know. I still had Raptors in five up until this game. It was disappointing from a lot of aspects. A lot of people are looking now past this series once again. It seems like that angst comes up after every loss, and we'll get to questions here in about 5 minutes. Once again, this is HQ Overtime. I'm joined by Justin Rowan. Tweet us your questions at RaptorsHQ and at myself at John Godes, JohnGaudes. I know we'll try to get to everybody here. A couple more things I wanted to talk about, though. Just the start for the Raptors. Out of the gate, they just didn't have the energy that they showed in Game 3. They're a more talented roster than the Pacers, but the intensity was a little bit lower. Is that something that they can solve by putting Patterson in the starting lineup, or is this just an issue where guys have to try a little bit harder?
I think Patterson helps. I think increased spacing is going to make things a lot easier. It really does come down to the decision-making of both Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan in my eyes, because they're forcing the issue. They're going isolation. Often, as I mentioned earlier, Jonas has been setting up good post position, but Lowry and DeRozan keep attacking on the right side of the court, where Jonas is setting up on the left. Now, that's fine. A lot of teams do that because they swing the ball over. But once Lowry and DeRozan decide they're not swinging it and they're either going to back their guy down and shoot a turnaround shot, or they're going to try to attack off the dribble, the whole offense kind of stagnates, because it looks like they're trying to set something up. And it kind of feels like they're hijacking the offense a little bit, which was a problem in the playoffs before. We saw Grievous Vasquez, Lou Williams do that, and it kills the flow of the team. They got to get back to playing their game, trusting the process over results. If the shots miss, the shots miss. But if you're running the offense, you're going to have more consistent looks for everybody. Everybody's not guessing what they need to do. And to answer your question, yeah, I think adding Patterson into the lineup works, but ultimately it comes down to your decision makers making the right decisions.
Yeah, and to your point, Lowry and DeRozan had 9 of the team's 12 assists. Obviously, a disproportionate amount of the offense is going through those guys, and it's about the decisions that they make. And just 12 team assists is way too low for this team. They play a half-court set. They're one of the slowest teams by pace in the association. So it's really predicated on Lowry and DeRozan making good decisions, like you say. And if they have 9 of the team's 12 assists, they had 9 of the team's 17 turnovers as well. So they were coughing the ball up just as often as they were making good decisions. And I mean, all over the place, it was just not a very good afternoon for the Raptors. Let's dive in a little bit more into Lowry here before we get to people's questions. He fouled out today, 4 for 12. He still hasn't shot a good percentage in any game this series. And there's a little bit of talk, not a lot, that more of the blame should be put on Lowry, because he has the ability to impact the game in so many different ways. He was 0 for 5 on threes today, maybe took a few too many of those Steph Curry type shots where he pulls up and takes long threes. I'm not long on the analytics with Kyle Lowry, but he, you know, it was another disappointing afternoon for him. How much of this is on him as well? And can we maybe put equal blame on him and DeRozan, or is DeRozan the more frustrating player from your point of view?
I mean, I think equal blame is fair, because Kyle Lowry is the primary initiator of the offense. So when he's doing the same isolation crap, when he's not getting them into their sets, he needs to take more of the responsibility. DeRozan played like absolute garbage, but sometimes that just happens. Kyle Lowry needs to get DeRozan going. He needs to call out the plays. He needs to make sure that Jonas consistently gets touches. I mean, 6 for 7 shooting. Like, that's fantastic. The Pacers haven't had an answer for him all series, and they just go away from him. That's not what they need him to do. They wanted to compare themselves to the Pistons with Chauncey Billups, Rip Hamilton, Rasheed Wallace, as a team that without a true superstar could contend. But the Pistons had Chauncey Billups, who probably did a better job than anybody of making sure everybody gets the right amount of touches, knows when to take shots, when to defer to other people. Lowry needs to follow that type of an example. He needs to be the leader on the floor. So because he has more responsibility, I think he either gets an equal or greater share of the blame in my eyes.
Yeah, I love that comparison too. I've made that in my head too with the Pistons of the mid-2000s, because they don't have a true superstar in this team. Mm-hmm. They're two kind of tier three all-stars. You know, they've got the onus on them to create for other people, because they can't do what Paul George does and take over a game and win it by themselves. Right. I mean, there was the one game against your Cleveland Cavaliers, I think, where Kyle Lowry took over and won the game. But I didn't see a lot of that this season, and I don't expect to see a lot of that. Those two guys kind of share the load, and they're expected to share it with their teammates as well. We have quite a few questions to get to, so I'm just going to start jumping into those here. If you want to get them in for the end here, you can tweet at Raptors HQ and at myself at John Godes, J-O-H-N-G-A-U-D-E-S. And a few of these are going to go back to things we talked about already, but I'm just going to go in chronological order here. From Earfan S at the Real RF tweets in, we saw Vogel put in Turner to start at the four. What rotation adjustments can Dwayne Casey make for game five? An interesting question. I think this has been a series of adjustments as opposed to what Steve Clifford talked about on Wednesday. The two coaches have kind of gone back and forth by changing lineups, changing how they rotate through. My answer to this question would be, I don't know what adjustments are made past Powell maybe getting a few more minutes, but again, I don't know what you can do. I don't think Casey's going to take Scola out at this point. He's been stubborn on that all year, but maybe you have a different perspective on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree. I think Casey isn't going to make the adjustment, and that's frustrating. But I think starting Patrick Patterson's the right call. Basically, I'd give whatever minutes Scola has to Norm Powell and make that small ball, make those kind of the small ball minutes, and play Patrick Patterson with the starters. Give him his 25 minutes a game, 25, 30 minutes. Maybe more Corey Joseph, benching DeRozan when he needs to be benched, kind of thing. Obviously, you can't bench him overall because then you just, his confidence is shot and you probably lose him in free agency, which I don't think is ideal. So maybe fewer minutes for DeRozan, no minutes for Scola, starting Patterson, and more for Norm would be my suggestion.
Yeah, I think in a dream scenario, that would be mine too. I don't know if it happens just because of how stubborn he is, but if we could dream, and we have dreamed on this show over the last few games, I think that's what happens. Next question here from Jackson at JManBoy. Why is Dwayne Casey playing T-Rod Scola so many minutes and not playing Powell, Corey Joseph, and Jonas Valanciunas more minutes? Just looking at how that those minutes break down. I think the interesting aspect of this question, and not to take other parts out of it, is if Terrence Ross should be a rotation player, because I think this is a contentious point among fans and maybe among a few writers as to whether Terrence Ross is good enough, whether he gives you enough on defense to be in that, I'm not going to say extended rotation. They played 10 tonight, but Dwayne Casey would ideally like to play nine players in his rotation. Should Terrence Ross be on the outside looking in your point of view?
My God, he played 19 minutes tonight. When I first heard that question, I was like, I don't remember seeing Terrence Ross out there that much. And I mean, in the way that kind of answers the question, doesn't it? It's discouraging that the guy they just gave a 3-year, $33 million extension is in the conversation for, should he really be playing? Should he be on the outside of this playoff rotation for Norman Powell? And they have a similar question with DeRozan coming up in free agency. So to me, yes, Ross should be on the outside looking in. I don't think he's bringing enough for them. This is now, again, kind of like Lowry and DeRozan, this is the third playoffs in a row where he hasn't made a big impact. This is discouraging. And there's always so much politics with who plays and who doesn't. The contract's obviously going to be a big factor, because if Dwayne Casey isn't playing Terrence Ross, then Masai's going to be putting that pressure on him, or at least you would anticipate that he'd do that. So it's tough, but I think limiting his minutes is the right call.
Yeah, I come in a little bit different on this. I think that Ross is probably a rotation player, but 19 minutes, you're right. I barely saw him in this game. He was 2 for 9, mm-hmm. 7 points, didn't have a turnover. But again, he's not impactful enough on the defensive end to make as much of a difference, I think, as Norman Powell does, because Powell is a two-way player against a team in the Pacers, especially, who a lot of their offense is initiated by their backcourt if George Hill plays like he does today. And Powell can see Paul George on the by playing defense on him as well. So I would like to see those swap. You know, Powell played 12 minutes, Ross played 19. I think that Powell deserves to be up in that 20 to 25 minute range. I don't think he takes from DeRozan's minutes at all, because DeRozan still played 33 despite his play. But yeah, that's an interesting question. I wonder if that changes a little bit as we move down the road here in this series. This was a good question from Chuck at Elopan. Why did we let ourselves get fooled into thinking this team turned a corner? Will we ever learn? I guess this isn't really a question for you. I don't know if we'll ever learn. I expected in that fourth quarter that they would come back and make it like a 6 to 7 point game and then blow it at the end, because that would have been classic Raptors right there.
Right. Man, yeah, they didn't. They disappointed our already low expectations, which is frustrating. And like, I think why, like, I'm just so dejected with how this postseason has kind of unfolded for Toronto is because I spent so much of the season, and as somebody that Raptors aren't my primary team, but I've been saying, no, this is a different team. DeMar DeRozan is better. He's keeping his head up. He's got an improved dribble. He can get to the rim. He knows when to kick it out, when to drive it. But every single bad habit, every skeleton has come pouring out of the closet, and here we are. Series is tied. A lot of questions surrounding Lowry and DeRozan again. A lot of questions surrounding Dwayne Casey and the coaching staff in regards to the rotations, in-game adjustments. It's like they're back to square one again, and it's frustrating.
Yeah, the angst is definitely going to be high for this Game 5, and they did that to themselves, unfortunately. A couple questions regarding DeMar DeRozan to go back to that topic. Russell Peddle, who writes for HQ, tweeted in, where is the pendulum on DeMar's max now? Can 4 playoff games erase the whole season? And this, it ties into a general conversation. We got a question from Mike from Down Under in the comment section. Would we want to keep DeMar? I think the larger conversation here is, A, has DeMar DeRozan hurt the dollar amount that he's going to get in the offseason? And B, which I think is the more apt question to ask, is he worth it to the Raptors?
Well, I don't think he's going to lose any money in free agency just because there's so many teams that are going to have that cap space. And there's not a great free agent crop. So he's going to get that max money. I'd seriously consider letting him go. It was brought up during the game. I was having a debate, I forget with whom, but about signing DeRozan and then trading him. But I think if you sign him to a 5-year deal, at that money, you're not going to get a great return. You might get a bunch of good rotation players, but Toronto's full of good rotation players. I think you're better off sticking with the cap space, going after Nick Batum, going after Al Horford, going after those type of guys, because you have depth at the shooting guard position. You have Norman Powell. You kind of have Terrence Ross, I guess. So I think they should explore their options and not rush to extend DeRozan.
Yeah, I would agree at this point. My feelings on this change from game to game, but we've now seen 4 straight games from DeRozan where he's been close to awful. He was awful today in the playoffs, and he hasn't been a playoff performer in his career. Typically, he's better on the road than he is at home, but that hasn't played out in this series. I think you do have to take a close look at, you know, the long-term impact of a contract like that. I think it's quoted at 5 years at the 30% max, which is just shy or just over of $150 million. And that's a decision where you've now committed to the core. If you're Masai Ujiri, you've now committed to the core of Lowry and DeRozan for at least 2 years. And I don't know if that's the decision you want to make. If you let him go, there's not enough money to sign another max player. So it's not like we're getting a choice in the matter. It's either, you know, having a max player in DeRozan or signing one, maybe two smaller pieces, like a Damari Carroll size piece in free agency. So it's a really good argument. I think depending on how this series goes, we'll see how it plays out. I think, you know, it's really interesting. I don't know where to fall on that. It changes game by game, but it's a conversation we need to keep having, and I enjoy having it. Another question here from the comments section, Mo Ron. This is concerning the refereeing. His first aspect to this is, my question is, why does the reffing change so much in the playoffs compared to the regular season? And he thinks it's bull that the fouls that would probably get called in the regular season no longer get called in the playoffs. I guess the answer to this is, that's how it's always been. And it's frustrating from a lot of aspects. And there's kind of been a whistle in this series where Paul George gets calls. But again, that's almost how it's always been, where superstars get calls. I don't know if you have a different vantage point on that.
Yeah, The thing is, I think Lowry and DeRozan's reputation of trying to draw and embellish contact goes against them, and I think it was smart of Vogel to try to bring that up. Because when you're looking at it, Indiana really does play physical defense, and they're putting a body, and it's all lower body contact on drives. But you see Indy, and like let's say Mahimi, for example, he's pushing out with his hip trying to bump or disrupt Lowry and DeRozan. And then you got Lowry and DeRozan trying to drag their arms and body throughout it. So I think if Lowry and DeRozan were just going for the shot and that contact comes, then they're going to get the call. But because they're trying to embellish that contact and they're not even looking to make a shot, they're throwing the ball out of bounds or they're firing up a wild look, I think the refs are letting that go. Because the narrative is that the refs swallow the whistles. But you look even in Houston, James Harden still gets the same calls or his free throw rate remains the same. And I think it's all about whether or not you look like you're actually have some sort of intent of making the shot or if you're just looking for a bailout. And with Lowry and DeRozan struggling with their shots, they're looking for those bailouts and those bailouts aren't coming rather than maybe what the calls would have been if they're just playing the game.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's get to a couple more here. From Andrew Patterson at Visibly Noisy, a predictable question. He says, where is James Johnson for the first four games when the starters and bench struggle? What happened to next man up? The James Johnson discussion is another one that is happening at the moment. I don't think he has a place in this series, and I've said that in the past few shows. He has the plantar fasciitis. He's been slow on his feet. He's not the team defender that this team needs right now. I know the individual defense has been something that he's shown in the last three seasons, but again, that's been flashes. It's all about consistency, and James Johnson hasn't shown it. The concept of next man up with Dwayne Casey, I think, appeals to the rotation as it exists right now, and I think outside anything below Norman Powell probably won't see a look in this series.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we need to go too in-depth. He's not that good, especially with his limitations with the plantar fasciitis. But, yeah, his defense is inconsistent. He can't shoot. He can drive, but we're seeing that Indy's clogging up the paint, and guys that are great drivers can't even finish in DeRozan and Lowry. So he doesn't have a place in the series. It's that simple.
Yeah, okay. We'll get to one more here. How many minutes will Scola play for the rest of the series if they start Miles Turner? I think the ideal, The ideal is that he comes off the bench and plays against Solomon Hill, who stretches the floor but is less of a threat than Miles Turner is. I think Scola, you know, he doesn't have a place in all of this series, to be totally honest. But if he has to play minutes, I'd rather see him come off the bench and play against bench lineups. You know, I mentioned this on the show after game three, and I wrote about this in the Game 3 article. I think 8 or 9 minutes off the bench is the maximum you want to see Luis Scola in this series.
Yeah, I'm done with him. He really shouldn't be playing out. Like I said, when Jonas has it going offensively and he has the right matchup, that's your post scoring. Any touches Scola gets down low should be going to him. If you want Scola to be a three-point threat, you're better off playing Patterson. He doesn't do anything better than the other options in this series. So he shouldn't be playing.
Yeah, that's the simplest way that you can put it, is that he doesn't do anything better than Patrick Patterson does. And I don't care if the mentality is Patrick Patterson is more comfortable coming off the bench. It's the playoffs, man. Like, we need these minutes. If they're going to play Miles Turner and Jan Mahimi in the starting lineup, we need Patrick Patterson to play with Jonas Valanciunas to match up on both ends. So
the Raptors need Stan Van Gundy. Did you hear him about Drummond after the game?
Yeah.
Why he benched him in the fourth quarter? He can't do anything to help us. If that's Luis Scola right now. He can't do anything to help you. Bench him. It's that simple.
Yeah, absolutely. That question I didn't mention, it was from David Mann at David Mann CDN. I know, David, you tweeted in a couple more. But in the last few minutes here before we let you go, Justin, I know you got perspective on the rest of the Eastern Conference playoff picture. Raptors fans are feeling down about their chances right now after that game. But it's worth having a discussion how you feel things are shaping up. And maybe we can start with the series that you're following the closest with the Cavaliers. Quite a few competitive games, like entertaining games from what I've seen, but the you know, the coming out party almost of Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love for the national audience to see here has been pretty cool to see those guys shooting the ball much better than what I saw earlier in the season.
Yeah, it's really nice to see the big three all play together well. Kyrie is playing out of his mind, which is good because he's kind of been a little inconsistent coming off that knee surgery this season. But we're seeing more of what we saw last year in the playoffs, even though Kyrie was playing hurt the whole time. His field goal percentage was great. He's now shooting over 16 career playoff games. Now he's shooting 47% from three. That's just fantastic. Kevin Love was great against Boston last year, but then he had his arm pulled out of his socket. So that hasn't happened yet. So that's encouraging. Detroit is a very good team. I'm very impressed with them. Good young team, well coached. The Cavs have managed to pull away in the last couple games. They won game two by about 20 and won game three by 10. But Detroit has made those games closer than the final scores would indicate. So I'm very encouraged with how well the big three is playing together. And it's funny, this is the second time in LeBron's career that he's not the leading scorer in a playoff series. And this is the first time it's because someone else is just playing better. And that's Kyrie being the leading scorer. And the only other time that's happened for LeBron is the 2011 finals.
Yeah, that's definitely reassuring for the Cavaliers. I know the Pistons have played really well. They've been fun to watch. I think, the like Stan Van Gundy said, the Andre Drummond problem is very exacerbated in the playoffs. They can't play him down the stretch, which is unfortunate. So, but they're an exciting team to watch going into the future, definitely. As you look forward to other series here, does anyone else in the Eastern Conference stand out as a big threat to the Cavaliers? And I know you're probably going to say the Miami Heat, but what about them gives you any, you know, doubt about matchup problems or anything like that? Because I think out of any Eastern Conference series, that's what people are going to be excited about.
Yeah, and it's funny because I picked Charlotte to beat Miami in the first round, and I still think Charlotte would have, but now Nick Batum is out for the rest of the series. As we're talking right now, Charlotte's currently up 4 on Miami. They're trying to hold serve with home court. The thing with Miami, even though they're not a great three-point shooting team, they are playing that small ball with Luol Deng at the 4. So how Kevin Love reacts to that and the adjustments that Tyronn Lue makes, I think is going to be the biggest challenge. I don't see them as a huge threat. If they had Chris Bosh, that would be a very different story. But I think they can make it a series. It probably would go about 6 games if it does go there. Although I'll say if Toronto does get it together, they did play well against Miami throughout the regular season. I wouldn't be stunned if Toronto beat them and still made the Eastern Conference Finals. I know we're trying to focus on them getting out of round one. But really, they are the better team. It just comes down to whether or not Toronto's going to keep shooting themselves in the foot and choking.
Yeah, that's an appropriate way, I think, to close this one off. Justin, thanks for joining me. I know you're on Twitter, at CavsAnada. That should be easier for people to remember. Where else can people find you? Where are you writing for during the postseason here?
Hoops Habit would be the other main spot that I'm putting most of my writing into. You can also find me Hoops Lounge. Do videos basically every Saturday, and we kind of split them up and post them throughout the week. But best way to find those is on my Twitter account. I share them on there. But yeah, Fear the Sword and Hoops Habit would be the two main spots where you can find my writing this postseason.
Perfect. Well, thanks. Thank you for joining me. I know this isn't your primary team, but I appreciate you taking the time.
No problem. Thanks for having me, John.
All right. So that is HQ Overtime. We'll be back for another live show after Game 5 on Tuesday night. That should be an interesting game. Look for the post-game thread on RaptorsHQ.com. You can tune in from Twitter at RaptorsHQ or on our Facebook page, which is RaptorsHQ.com. You can also subscribe to archive podcasts of this show and our weekly podcast, The Headquarters, on iTunes. Give us a rating and review. It is always greatly appreciated. Once again, thanks to Justin Rowan for joining me. That's HQ Overtime, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.